Today on the 21st Show, the writer Adam Gopnik. In nearly four decades at The New Yorker, he's written about everything from politics and art to his life in New York and Paris. He's also the author of many best-selling books, the latest of which explores the subject of how people become masters in areas as diverse as magic, boxing, and baking. It's called The Real Work, on the Mystery of Mastery. I'm Brian Mackey with Adam Gopnik for The Hour, today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The writer Adam Gopnik is arguably best known for his long association with The New Yorker magazine. It began in 1986, and he spent time as the magazine's art critic and Paris correspondent before returning to cover life in New York City. But Gopnik's interests go well beyond his award-winning magazine work. He's written a musical and a one-man show. He acted in the critically acclaimed movie Tar with Cate Blanchett. And he's recently done a podcast with Steve Martin. And as if that wasn't enough, he's also written a dozen or so books, the most recent of which is called The Real Work, on the Mystery of Mastery. Now, despite the title, the publisher advises booksellers to put it not in the self-help section, but in psychology, where it shares space with titles about overcoming anxiety and managing ADD. Personally, I don't know that that's quite the right fit either, though, and I'm not sure there even is one bookstore section that can contain Gopnik's multitudes. But the book, The Real Work, is, in Adam's own description, a self-help book that won't help. He writes that he means that in the shallow sense of helping you immediately to do the things the book is about doing better. He says it offers no shortcuts or bullet points and provides no recipes, except one or two for sourdough bread. Yet I hope that it might help you better see yourself as a self, a constructed self made out of appetites turned into accomplishments. Joining us now to talk about what that means is the man himself, Adam Gopnik. Welcome to the 21st Show.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Brian.
And I've got to say, as a longtime New Yorker reader, this is a real thrill for me. So thank you so much for being with us today. And I do want to begin by acknowledging that you and your family suffered a loss. You lost the family dog today. I want to start with condolences to you.
Thank you, Brian. It's kind and sensitive of you to note that. We did. I'm in London right now here doing some speaking. And at 6 a.m., I'm afraid we had to put our beloved Butterscotch to sleep. My daughter Olivia showed incredible character and care in holding her. She was 13 at the outer edge of the life of a Havanese, and she'd been ill for a long time. So it came as no shock to any of us. But, you know, I profiled her, Butterscotch R. Havanese, in the New Yorker.
The dog that became your master, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Back in 2010, because we were, if not a dog-adverse family, we were at least a dog-adverse couple, my wife Martha and myself. And we were, you know, I wrote at the time, and I think it's true, you know, they always say about the British Constitution that it's not written, but it's effective, unlike our own. And I wrote at the time that the constitution that governs relations between parents and children is also unwritten. But one feature of it is that at the age of 10, if a child wants a dog desperately enough, they get a dog. And we got the dog, and she changed our life. My wife, Martha, became her primary caregiver and lover, and she became my beloved companion, and she listened to paragraphs that I was working on when we walked. There's simply nothing, I think, that prepares you for it. I will tell you, Brian, actually, in the very first draft of this book, The Real Work, I included an adapted chapter, how the dog, based on that essay, How the Dog Becomes Your Master, because I thought that for someone like me who was a little phobic about dogs, I was bitten when I was a kid, to fall in love with a dog was in itself a form of mastery. But in talking it over with my editor, I realized that caring for a dog isn't really a kind of mastery, or if there is a mastery, it's the dog's mastery of us. That's what it, that's the way the mastery runs. It's an act of love. And I know all the dog lovers in your audience will recognize that there's simply this extraordinary asymmetry. It's one of the great kind of unsung sadnesses in life, that we love our pets and our animals quite unreasonably. And when we lose them, the loss is quite overwhelming, even though we all recognize that it's a loss that in some sense always has to remain private. It's difficult to communicate outside the family circle. So thank you, Brian, for mentioning it.
No, and that's very well said. I knew a very powerful man in Illinois political circles once who lost his dog and, you know, was really bereft and said, why do we keep doing this to ourselves?
Yes. Well, but that's a good question. And it's a question that speaks, I think, somewhat to the contents of life, more important than the book, but it also of the book. You know, why do we keep doing it to ourselves? Because the joy and the challenge of having a shape to the day, of having something that you have to do. You know, at the heart of the pandemic, Butterscotch was the rhythm of life. Things had to be done with her, for her, and about her, and she gave so much. I think that's why we do it.
Well, let's use that as a point, an entry point then, into talking about the book itself, the mystery, or the real work on the mystery of mastery. So, and maybe we can begin with a definition. What do you mean by mastery?
Well, I mean by it, the real work. What I mean by it is not technical expertise alone, though that's a very powerful thing. And I don't mean by it necessarily kind of the supreme mastery we associate with great once in a generation artists. I mean, the kind of mastery that's available, first of all, to all of us, whether we're, as I did, starting at the age of 12, locked in my own bedroom, mastering Beatle chords, or as my son later did with a deck of cards in his hand, mastering the basis of sleight of hand by reading the great Erdnase, to women who learned sewing, to my daughter who led the way into boxing. That kind of mastery is available to all of us. And one of the blessings is it's available to all of us at any age. By that mastery, I don't mean the preeminent mastery of the greatest practitioners. I mean the available mastery that can come to anyone who perseveres passionately in a pursuit.
Maybe we can pause on that and talk about the difference then between technical virtuosity and mastery as you see it.
Well, the additional thing, so come back to the title, The Real Work. That's an expression that's used by magicians, and I took it from, borrowed it from the magicians I knew, who I always heard in conversation. And magicians are the best conversationalists with each other on the planet. They have the best shop talk of any group of people I've ever met, exactly because they can only talk about their shop with each other. They have to keep it hidden from everyone else. So when they have a chance to open up, it's joyous and rapt. And they always say to each other, who's got the real work on that? You know, if they're talking about anything, say, you know, the Erdnase color change, who's got the real work on that? Or Flosso's illusion, who's got the real work on that? And I heard magicians talking this way, and I wondered, what were they referencing? What did they mean? And over time, through the osmosis, the absorption of hearing and seeing how what they said related to what they were pursuing, I realized that by the real work, they didn't mean who did a trick or an illusion or an effect with the greatest technical virtuosity. And they didn't mean who had invented it. What they meant was who did the trick or the effect with absolute technical virtuosity, but added to that technical virtuosity, what I think of as a kind of empathetic anticipation of the audience. So that's the key to magic, right? Is knowing what the audience expects and surprising them always. That's why great magicians no longer do all the familiar cliches of magic, rabbits out of a hat or sawing a woman in half. If Penn and Teller do those things, they don't pull a rabbit, they pull a rabid rodent out of the hat, and they don't, and if they cut the woman in half, instead of doing it neatly, they have pretend blood flowing. They always are trying to surpass and our expectations. That's what great magicians do, and it's what all all of us are trying to do all the time. Even when you learn something, Brian, as simple as boxing, which is something I've been studying for the last couple of years with a wonderful teacher named Joey Contrada. The only way you can learn to box is to take the set of punches, of blows that your teacher gives you, turn them into a kind of seamless sequence through sheer perseverance. But you're always thinking about the imaginary other boxer. Nothing you do, even if you're just shadow boxing, even if you're just boxing in the mirror, nothing you do has any meaning, has any intent, unless you're imagining the other boxer who's trying to outwit you. And all of mastery involves that back and forth between expectation and its defeat, between anticipation and being ahead of the audience. Even things that are less obviously surprising than magic, singing, for instance. All the great singers I know, and I, as you mentioned, I'm fortunate enough to work nights and weekends in the musical theater. All the great singers talk about being one beat ahead of the audience, always one step ahead of the audience's expectations. So this is a long-winded answer, forgive me, but that's what I mean by mastery. I mean that combination of technical proficiency with an engagement with other minds, with other people and their anticipations. And that's a kind of mastery that is, at least in its foundational forms, available to all of us.
Are there, I mean, you've been a writer for so long, and maybe you don't want to name anyone. Are there technically virtuous writers who you think are, you know, fall short of the definition of master? And I don't know if you
want to choose someone. You're really putting me on
the spot. Choose someone deceased, maybe, if you don't want to risk alienating friends and enemies.
I might be one of them. Let me turn the question around to put it in a slightly different way. The greatest writers I know, either firsthand or through the more important experience of reading, invariably combine a certain kind of technical proficiency with a unique human sound. I was lucky enough actually to know John Updike, who was as much of a prestidigitator of prose as anyone could be. And, you know, when we read Updike, he had all of the ingredients, you know, it's like those five tool baseball players we hear about, right? Can hit and hit for power and field and so on. Well, Updike was a five tool writer. He had an enormous linguistic shimmer, an instant access to exactly the right word at every moment, a fantastic ear for dialogue, and so on. All the tools a writer can have. But what made him remarkable was the way that he infused that kind of technical proficiency with a very specific kind of quaver, a specific kind of tremolo of an abandoned boy, a boy in from rural Pennsylvania who never felt that he fit in. Not an abandoned boy so much as a marginalized boy who never felt he fit in with the literary world of New York and was always writing from a kind of a middle American distance. So, and every writer who we love, I think, has that quality. It's a quality we call voice on the page. And it's as distinct, the voice of every good writer, as the vibrato of Judy Garland or every great singer. And when a writer, and so you can be hugely technically proficient as a writer and be extremely boring because there's no voice on the page. And when I'm trying to teach writing to the very limited degree that I do, that's all we talk about, finding your voice, articulating your voice, getting your imperfection as a human being, your vulnerability as a human being down on the page. You know, I was at, of all places, in the course of taking this book around America, as writers are obliged to do. I am the Willie Loman of American literature, you know, peddling my wares from one place to another. But one place I ended up peddling my Willie Loman-like wares was Tulsa, Oklahoma, a wonderful town. And there I got to go to, of all things, the Bob Dylan Center, Bob Dylan Museum. And there was a wonderful letter from Bob Dylan I noticed there. It's where Dylan gave all of his archives. And in it he says, And you know, a lesson of life, Brian, is that everybody, even the greatest masters, are sensitive to criticism. And Dylan clearly had heard people saying, hey, he can't really sing. He's a good songwriter, can't really sing. And he says, in effect, this isn't a precise quote, but this was the sense of it. I know I'm not a note for note a great singer, but I breathe really well. And if you want to understand my singing, you have to understand my breathing. And if you think about it, that's absolutely true, right? We don't listen to Bob Dylan because we think, oh, he'll like a tenor at the Metropolitan Opera, he'll land every note. He lands alongside the note, on top of the note, below the note, five fields away from the note. Dylan's breathing is part of the sound of our generation, my generation anyway, but the sound of America's, that Dylan's way of breathing in and out. That's the human frailty, if you like, in the certain sense, the human imperfection that Dylan brings to his performance, which makes him a master.
Yeah, and well, and we need to take a break in about a minute here, but I can't remember if I heard you say this in another interview or it's in the book, but you know, he did the 10,000 hours, right? But he did not become the world's greatest singer. He became the world's greatest Bob Dylan.
Yeah, that's in the book. Yes, exactly. That my dear friend Malcolm Gladwell, you know, talks about 10,000 hours. It's absolutely true. That's 6 years. If you break it down, that's 6 years of tireless devotion to a craft. And yes, we all need to give 6 years of tireless devotion to our craft. But what those 6 years give us is not a steady shared level of proficiency. It gives us some of that. But exactly, Bob Dylan spent 10,000 hours not becoming a great singer, but becoming Bob Dylan.
All right. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We are speaking with the writer Adam Gopnik. His most recent book is called The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. If you want to join our conversation, you can do so by giving us a call at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email anytime. talk@21stshow.org is the address. We'd love to hear from you what you think about what we've been talking about, or if you have a question for Adam Gopnik. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. We're going to talk more about some of the work that Gopnik tried to master that became the seeds of this book. And I hope we can also talk a little bit about politics, because he spends a lot of time thinking and writing about that as well. That's all coming up today on the 21st show. Do stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are spending the hour today talking with the writer Adam Gopnik, best known for his long association with The New Yorker magazine, but he's also written musicals. He's been an actor. He's been doing a podcast with Steve Martin, or has done a podcast with Steve Martin, and he's written many books, the most recent of which is called The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. It's about not just mastery, but really the pursuit of mastery and the idea that it's available to anyone at any age. If you want to join our conversation today, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So, Adam, as I was preparing for this conversation, I fortuitously came across a line from Peter Drucker, the great business sort of guru thinker, from his essay, Managing Oneself. He wrote, "One should waste as little effort as possible on improving areas of low competence. It takes far more energy and work to improve from incompetence to mediocrity than it takes to improve from first-rate performance to excellence." What do you think of that?
Well, obviously, I don't agree with it. In fact, one of the driving ideas in the book is that we can do extraordinary self-work, if you like, exactly by taking on tasks seriously and accomplishments that we'll never be supremely good at. I imagine, to be charitable to Drucker, that he was writing about the organization. He was writing about business, and we don't want people in our business who are, we don't want people answering the phone who can't speak, and we don't want people doing the accounting in the accounting department who can't add. That's at that level, certainly that's true. But what I have found, and what not only I have found, but what I think is confirmed by psychological science and by our common experience at the same time, is that it's exactly by engaging in things we may never be good at that we remake ourselves, keep ourselves alive, if you like, keep ourselves young. And there's a reason for that. It's not just a cliche. You know, in order to master anything, even at a kind of rudimentary level, you have to throw yourself into it. We were talking about boxing before. Now, I will never be, not only will I never be a champion boxer, I'll probably never even get into the ring. I won't ever get into the ring for a proper fight with anyone unless they can find another 5'4" Jewish intellectual who has a grudge and wants to win and money. But there's nothing in my life that gives me a greater sense of meaning than the boxing lessons I take twice a week. It's partly because it's aerobic and exhilarating and all of those good things, but it's basically because every week I get a little bit better. My wonderful teacher, Joey Contrada, shows me how to, jab, jab, cross, slip, uppercut, that very familiar sequence. If you've ever watched a boxing match, you always start with the jab, testing your opponent, then your right cross, if you're right-handed, is your power shot, and so on. And the more that you internalize that set of steps that are just as tightly choreographed as any ballet, the more you internalize them, the less they become these kind of stumbling, awkward, what do I do now? Do I jab or do I cross? And they just become this seamless sequence. And the sense of what some psychologists call the flow that overcomes us at that moment, the sense of rapturous absorption in an activity outside ourselves, which after all is what happiness always is. It's why we love dogs so much, because they rapturously absorb us in an activity, caring for them, that lies outside ourselves. And the more you do that, the greater your access to the flow, which may very often be difficult for us to find in the things we do extremely well. Once we're really good at something, Brian, you know how to interview people. And yet I'm sure that at the end of each show, there's a little part of you that nags you and says, that interview could have been even better if I had done this or that. Mm-hmm. Every time I sit down to write a paragraph, I imagine in my mind that it's going to have these sensual rhapsodic acuity of John Updike and the psychological intricacy of Marcel Proust and the witty forthright qualities of Jane Austen. And of course it doesn't. It only sounds like me. And so we live our lives and the things we do well in a state of perpetual dissatisfaction. That's part of what it means to master something so that you do it really well. But in the things we learn later on, we don't have to feel that way. Any access to accomplishment that we find is great. You know, the French, you know, as you know, I lived in France for many years. There's a wonderful expression in France. You talk about the violin d'Ingres, the violin of Ingres. Ingres was, of course, a great 19th century painter, but his passion in life was the violin. Now, he was the greatest draftsman in the world and a fantastically gifted painter. And everybody says he was a so-so second violin, but he loved the violin. And I think everyone who's creative at all has a violin of their own, something that they're passionate about, that gives them the instant reward of rapture, the flow, happiness, that fuels their ability to do their primary passion. Our secondary passions, I think, are essential to pursuing our primary passions.
Yeah, no, that reminds me of, when I was in, I think, high school, maybe early college, I used to carry around a newspaper clipping from the great Chicago columnist Mike Royko that was about Michael Jordan's foray into professional baseball. And Royko was really taking to the many journalists and media organizations that had mocked Jordan's attempt to completely play a different sport. But I think you can probably find some sympathy with what he was doing in that instance.
Absolutely. You know, I never thought about that as an example, but it's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Exactly. That's what the French would call the violin d'Ingres of Michael Jordan was baseball. And Jordan is a perfect example of what I was talking about in terms of the perpetual dissatisfaction of the sublimely accomplished. Remember Michael Jordan in that memorable documentary we all watched during the pandemic was never satisfied with his own performance. He was never satisfied with anyone else's performance either. And he lived, I guess still does live his life in a state of perpetual fascinating indignation at all the people who held him back. And we all say, held him back? He's Michael Jordan. But he had to internalize it that way. And baseball was, for him, what the violin was to Ingres, or what it to descend to a much more Lilliputian level, what boxing and drawing are to me.
So maybe it'd be helpful for our listeners to say, this is not one of those books that was like a stunt project, right? You weren't setting out to read the entire OED or live by the rules of the Old Testament. These are things that came up organically in your life.
Thank you for saying that, Brian. Yes, that's essential to the book. This was not something where I said to a publisher, let me go out and learn how to box and dance and draw and find out what it's like. No, each one of the things, each one of the essays in the book did come about exactly as you say, organically from something I had to do. Perhaps most memorably, at least in my life, and maybe in the book, was learning to drive, for instance. I didn't learn to drive until I was in my 50s, which will shock, I know, many of your listeners.
Especially in the Midwest here, yes.
That's what I meant. It's not being able to drive when you're 55 is startling on the East Coast, and it's somewhat unimaginable, I discovered, in Middle America, the Midwest. But I didn't because I had left college to come to New York City, and New York City is a place where surprisingly few people drive. So I never had a need to drive, but we would go up to, you know, the ocean like everybody in for the month of August. And my poor wife had to do all the driving, good driver, but it's exhausting to do all the driving. And I used to joke that I was sitting in what was traditionally the mother's seat. You know, I was the one saying, hey, kids, you got to calm down back there. You know, your mom's trying to find the exit, or, you know, passing out cookies saying, we're almost there. I promise you, we're almost there. That was my role. And I wanted to kind of move over into the driver's seat. And relieve her and be able to say, I'll go get the cinnamon rolls first thing in the morning. You don't have to do it. It seemed kind of like minimal marital responsibility. Finally. So I studied with another great teacher. And I like to think that the single best thing about this book are my descriptions of these wonderful, irascible, original teachers I was lucky enough to bump into. And this was Arturo Leon, wonderful Ecuadorian born driving teacher. And he took on the crazy task of teaching a 55-year-old nervous character to drive on the streets of New York City in the South Bronx and Upper Manhattan. And it was fantastic. And it was also a kind of learning that was very transferable. Arturo's great statement, as you know from reading the book, was become the noodle. That the key to driving is to become the noodle. And I said to him, Arturo, what do you mean become the noodle? And he said, you have to learn to be both have structure and shape, but be completely relaxed in everything you do, because you have to impress the driving judge, you know, the inspector, by constantly being in motion, checking your mirror, looking over your shoulder, looking to your right, be showing that you're totally engaged with the road rather than sitting there locked in terrified stasis, as I often was. So he would say to me again, Adam, become the noodle, become the noodle. And it turns out to be great advice because, as you know, Arturo eventually, as we became friends, asked me, said, you know, I'd love to write a book, said, about my system of teaching people to drive called Dream Driving. Tell me how you write a book. And I tried to articulate it because that's something I know how to do. And I said, well, you organize it and you outline. And I said, finally, Arturo, you become the noodle. The way to write a book is to become the noodle. Be totally flexible in terms of what you're addressing and yet have a firm vertical outline of where you're going. So learning to drive was something that I had to do and was delighted once I'd done it.
And you dedicate the book to your succession of teachers. And maybe we can turn this into a little self-help for me here, because anyone who's ever been on a Zoom call with me since the pandemic can see, and that's not how we're connecting today for my end of the conversation, so you can't, but there's an acoustic guitar over my shoulder resting in a corner of my office. I've had that thing for 20 years. I can play three chords. Now, like, I'm a hack pianist. I can play the drums pretty well, yet I have just never gotten over the inertia to actually learn the chords. Do I need a teacher? What do I need to do to unlock some adult pursuit of mastery with that?
Well, as I've written, that was my first experience of mastery was, you know, in my room at the age of 12 with a big book of Beatles songs with giant chord diagrams, stretching my fingers across the neck to make a bar chord, the F chord that you have to make. And then slowly, you know, painfully learning to adjust your fingers. I spent weeks locked in my bedroom doing that. I still play guitar. I don't play it well. I have played it on stage. This will be hard to believe, but I actually played it on stage at Carnegie Hall, if you can imagine, because I was doing a gig with James Taylor, the great the inimitable James Taylor, and he had the idea that it'd be good to teach me how to play a song, so he could give me a guitar lesson on stage. And since we all wanted a guitar lesson from James Taylor, I was, you know, standing in for the audience. So we did it. So I'm always able to say to everyone, you know, there are very few superlatives in life, but I can actually say that I am the worst musician ever to play his instrument on stage at Carnegie Hall. But I love playing guitar. And my being able to do it, and you can do it too. You just need to give yourself the time and the discouragement, because guitar, it takes us a little bit far afield. Guitar is a tough instrument. You know, it's so popular. It's so much the foundation. It's the music of our time is guitar. But guitar, though, it's a wonderful instrument because you can sing as you play it. It's a beautiful instrument. Is demanding in a way that piano isn't. When I started playing piano, I realized, oh, this is like a typewriter, the piano. You press the key and you get the sound. Producing sound on a guitar, well, much less a clarinet, is so much harder. But you sit with it and you do it and you get better at it. And another thing that's always going to be true, and just at a practical level, is there is always someone better than you are. My son, Luke, interestingly, took up the guitar as his major in university, classical guitar. He loves guitar. I taught him his first three chords, but now he's so far ahead of me that it's not, we're not even playing the same instrument. And yet one day when we were at a kind of cocktail party in New York City, and there was one kind of little rinky dink, band in spats.
They were dressed up like the Great Gatsby or something, you said.
Exactly, yeah. Borsellinos. And Luca stopped and listened, as good musicians do, and he said, "Dad, that guy playing the guitar dressed up like a gangster is a better guitar player than anyone I have ever worked with." And that's true, right? When you look around, mastery is all around us of that kind. People are really good at things. And that doesn't mean they have that ineffable, human, imperfect, idiosyncratic quality that makes the greatest masters the greatest masters. But that kind of mastery is all around us. And all of us can get someplace up the mountain. And again, to reiterate the kind of what's thematic in the book, no matter where we are in the mountain, if we persevere passionately in the pursuit of our accomplishment, whatever it is, we get the gift of the flow, happiness, absorption in something outside ourselves. And that's remarkably uniform, no matter what level you attain.
What was your, and we need to take another break in just a couple of minutes here, but what was your hardest journey of mastery?
Hardest journey of mastery? It's an interesting question. I suppose it was drawing, really. It was the one I wanted to do, again, not for some abstract reason, but for the simple compensatory reason that I had been a practicing art critic for, I don't know, almost 40 years at that point, and I had never learned to draw. And I found myself at a dinner table with someone who was a drawing master, and a little demon inside me said, "Ask him to teach you to draw." And I did. Another great teacher, Jacob Collins, an astonishing virtuoso draftsman. But I did not have any of the skills, you know, any of the simple coordinated skills with my hand. So I was stabbing away at the paper like Lady Macbeth with a dagger for the first beginning of it. And I literally, Brian, had tears in my eyes because I found it so resistant. But Jacob was a fantastic teacher. He taught me to relax my hand, to gesture underhand rather than stabbing overhand. And he taught me a series of very counterintuitive exercises that I could do that would loosen my hand and, more important, loosen my mind and my eyes, help me snap out of what he called the symbol set that's haunting your vision. You know, the way we deal in kind of stereotyped eyes and noses and mouths. And he taught me these wonderful counterintuitive schemas, like looking at a face as though it were the face of a clock, not the face of a person, and just registering what he called tilts in time, the exact time at which an eyebrow tilts. Is it 2:05 or 2:10? And so on. So drawing was really resistant to me, and I'm still not very good at it. But the little progress that I did manage to make was the most rewarding of all.
Lady Macbeth with a dagger. And that is why he is Adam Gopnik. We are going to continue our conversation after a short break. This is the 21st show. The book is called The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. More with Adam Gopnik. Stay with us. This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are speaking with the writer Adam Gopnik, best known for his long association with The New Yorker magazine, also the author of many books, including most recently The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. The big idea in the book, it traces his own journey over the last, decade plus of pursuing different activities from driving to taking up boxing to becoming a master draftsman, somebody who draws artistically. And the big idea is that it's about mastery being available to all of us, especially as adults. If you want to join our conversation, 800-222-9455 is the number. And let's now go to Lydia is calling in from Woodstock on line 4. Lydia, thanks so much for calling in today.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful to listen to your program in the past, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on air with you at this time. Today is Magna Carta Day. Of the calendars that we have here in the United States, June 15th has no holiday recognition. You have some familiarity with the importance of the Magna Carta. On June 15th in 2016, we were supposed to have the 800th anniversary of this wonderful document, which gave rights to people, and especially women, who were told just because they're widows, they will not have to leave and not have to remove themselves from house and home. I want to charter and sponsor a Magna Carta chartership because I am sick and tired of a so-called master on a red escalator taking the spotlight on the day that should have been given to people like me. Also, women throughout the world, and I will, as a business owner, sponsor a Magna Carta Day, take that on, and work it into International Women's Day.
All right. Well, Lydia, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that.
Can I jump in?
Please,
Brian?
Please, Adam, go ahead.
You know, up to what Lydia was saying, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, we might talk some politics, and I'd be delighted to do that. And it kind of gives me a way in. My previous book, as you may know, was called A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. And by liberalism, I didn't mean people who agree with the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. I meant the much broader movement for liberal democracy. That
liberal tradition, if you will. Yes,
exactly. Liberal tradition. And, you know, what's fascinating about what Lydia was saying about Magna Carta, right? And she's right. Magna Carta was a remarkable document. But, you know, it gave very limited rights to a very limited set of people. It treated women better than they had been treated before. Mostly gave rights to nobles, British nobles, against the king. And yet, she's absolutely right. It's a kind of foundational document in the incremental evolution of the idea of rights, of power sharing, above all, of pluralism. That's the crucial idea that liberalism has that no other political movement possesses, the centrality of pluralism. And the beautiful thing about history since that time is that with all of the horrible setbacks and reversals that we know with the hideous histories of discrimination and oppression, nonetheless, that march forward of pluralism has continued to our own day so that someone, you know, I write about my daughter in the book and I talked about her at the beginning of the program, about how beautifully, exquisitely she cared for our poor ailing and dying dog. But my daughter is queer. She lives with another woman. And the fact is that she would not have the opportunity to live her life, express her love until very, very recently in our history, and then only in a very few places. So the beautiful truth is that pluralism rights are always evolving. That's the thing we have to be proudest of. So we can look back at Magna Carta and say, oh my goodness, they were only giving rights to a very few people, and recognize that it's exactly through that kind of beginning that the incremental evolution of liberty can take place.
stepping forward. And it is, Lydia was right. It's not a document we celebrate perhaps as much as we should. I think I'm pretty sure I've seen a copy of it in Washington. I think it was the National Archives building.
You know who used to own several copies of it, if I remember correctly, was Ross Perot. Remember Ross Perot?
Yo, indeed.
Remember, we used to think Ross Perot was too eccentric to be president.
Well, on that note, and as long as we're talking politics, this was, I think, a few months ago, but you took credit, perhaps reluctantly, for being one of the first people to talk about then candidate, now former President Donald Trump, as a fascist, quote unquote. This was in early 2016, before it was even clear that he would be the Republican nominee for president. What did you see that many of us didn't, and why is that still a useful designation in your view?
Well, you know, nothing depends on words, and if you want to say, you know, deranged, anti-democratic, nationalist, authoritarian, fine. You know, I don't want to overinvest in a single word, but I think it's the right word, and the reason I wanted to emphasize it is because people were timid about evoking it or invoking it, I guess I should say. But the truth is that fascism is a very specific political movement, a very specific ideology. And one of the things that's most typical of it, it's right-wing authoritarianism, absolutely. It hates liberalism. It hates pluralism. It believes only in the VOPE, you know, the inner group. One group has a right to rule and everybody else should be eliminated from power. It believes in intolerance rather than tolerance. It believes in being broadly intolerant, and it has contempt for the slow incremental evolution, the building of compromise and coalition that's so typical of liberal democracies. But there's another side of it as well that's where Trump is connected with fascist ideology. The great Italian novelist and philosopher Umberto Eco, who grew up under fascism in Italy under Mussolini, described it very well. It's that the belief system is completely chaotic, deliberately chaotic. This is profoundly true of Mussolini, who was sometimes a corporatist, sometimes pro-capitalist, sometimes a socialist, sometimes an imperialist. There's a totally, sometimes Catholic, sometimes anti-Catholic, sometimes pagan, sometimes pious, completely incoherent ideology that is wrapped around and only around the charismatic example of the cult leader. So it's exactly, the point is the chaos, because it's through the chaos that you have to subscribe not to a set of beliefs, but to blind worship of the cult leader. I hardly need underline how exactly and precisely that tracks the way Trump works. You know, Trump is in favor of vaccines. He builds vaccines, and then that's unpopularity. He hates vaccines. He's in favor of economic nationalism, and he's against it. And by spinning constantly, rotating constantly his ideas, he compels his followers to have allegiance to nothing except himself. That's fascism.
Ah, now we're getting into why we may be living into 1984 as opposed to A Brave New World.
Yes.
Which is maybe a bit of a digression.
Yeah, but I did that as a debate, you know,
indeed,
here in London, actually, where I'm sitting right now with Will Self a few years ago. You can find it on YouTube. You know, Brave New World.
It's an entertaining watch, I must say.
Yeah, Brave New World. You know, is said that technology will be the undoing of us, and there are people. You know, we're talking about AI these days in that way, but Orwell had a central insight, which is that once human beings are enlisted somehow in a cult of intolerant, militant totalitarianism, they have an almost impossibly difficult time getting out of it. Once you've given your soul over to Big Brother owns it.
In the time we have remaining, which is only about 5 minutes, unfortunately, I do want to ask if we can talk a little bit about Robert Gottlieb. I understand you went to The New Yorker with him from the publishing.
I did indeed. It's a sad day. Bob passed away yesterday, and sympathies to his family, certainly. He was the third editor of The New Yorker after the founding editor, Howard Ross, and the long-standing and maybe most significant editor, William Shawn, who in participation with many another editor helped give the magazine its unique features. So did Ross, surely. Bob Gottlieb was an editor of genius, particularly when it came to mastering long and unwieldy manuscripts. One of the greatest achievements of his time editing The New Yorker, and I will forever be grateful for his generosity to me in hiring me first to write The Talk of the Town and then to be art critic. One of his greatest achievements were the John Cheever diaries. I don't know if you recall those, that for a while they were a rage. They even come into two episodes of Seinfeld from the mid-90s. But they were these amazing poetic and erotically confessional diaries that the great short story writer John Cheever kept. And it was just this unbelievably immense reservoir of material. And Gottlieb, and he might have been the only person who could have done this, managed to turn it into a manageable magazine piece of piercing poetic intensity. That was Bob's unique gift, was being able to take an oceanic manuscript and turn it into a navigable river.
Maybe this is a way to return to the book, the real work on the mystery of mastery, because he was certainly a masterful editor. You dedicate the book to everyone who teaches, and I think most great editors are great teachers in their way. But and you talk about your sometime creative partner, Kirk Varnadoe, with whom I know you curated an art exhibit back in the day. Why aren't all masters necessarily great teachers, though? And you've talked about yourself in that way as not maybe being the greatest writing teacher.
I don't know if I'm that big, great a master of writing, not to be disingenuous. It's the thing I do best, and I think I do it well. But I'm not a particularly good teacher because I'm very impatient. And what all the great teachers have in common, and it's what the great editors have in common, I'm blessed to work with two these days at The New Yorker, David Remnick, of course, and Henry Finder, the editorial director of the magazine who looks after my stuff day to day and week to week. And they have to be people who can subsume their ego into other people. That's what a great editor does, is it becomes an invisible visitor to your own ego, and you're not even aware that he's driving the car, so to speak. But I think that what the greatest teachers do, and I was lucky, and I dedicated the book to Kirk Varnadoe, a great art historian who was easily the greatest teacher I've ever known. I wrote a long essay about him called Last of the Metrozoids, which you can find in one of my books, but also online at The New Yorker. And what makes the great teachers great, and I think the line of teachers in this book, I hope, exemplifies this, is that they have an impossibly high standard that they never compromise. They're not the kind of people who pat you on the head and stick your drawing up on the refrigerator and say it's perfect. They always are telling you, you can do better, you can work harder, you can do more. But they combine that impossibly or incredibly high standard, not impossibly high standard, with an absolute commitment and an enormous patience with you if you're prepared to make the commitment. That's how Kirk Varnadoe taught me to work hard. Wasn't enough to be a smart guy. You had to be a smart guy who was willing to work 6 hours a day at things. But if you made that commitment, there was no limit to how much teaching he would do, how much mentoring, how much shaping. And every great teacher I've ever known, this book includes the great sleight of hand man, Jamie Ian Swiss, who taught my son magic, right through to Joey Contrada, even a wonderful cognitive behavioral therapist, Dan Rocker, who helped me with a phobia I struggled with. What they all have in common is a very high standard that they don't compromise, and incredible patience in helping you to meet that standard if you're prepared to commit to it, if you put in those acts of passionate perseverance. I'm not patient enough to commit to it. I hope I have a high standard. I get impatient. It doesn't make me a great teacher, but I think that makes me a good student.
Well, that is a great note on which to end. I think the path to the real work is just by doing the work. What a pleasure. Adam Gopnik, thank you so much for being with us today.
Brian, it was a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you for giving me all this time to speak.
The book is called The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery. And the author, again, is Adam Gopnik. You can find it wherever great books are sold. And before we go today, that is all the time we have for our program. I do want to ask you for your help in a program we're putting together for next week. Several states have banned gender-affirming care for trans youth. And while it's still available in Illinois, it's a difficult landscape for kids and teens and their families to navigate. What questions do you have about how gender-affirming care works for trans youth? What effect do you think that these care bans are having? And maybe if you know trans youth in your life, how are they doing? We want to hear from you. Give us, send us an email. talk@21stshow.org is the address. talk@21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.